Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, and Luke Savage, my esteemed co-host, is not here this week. He is undergoing a routine medical procedure. Nothing to worry about. His life is not under threat, but he will be out of commission for this episode and possibly the next episode as well. Fortunately, in his stead is somebody even better than Luke, I would say. a longtime friend of both Luke and mine and the podcast and you, the denizens of Michael and Us Nation. It is returning champion Alex Ross. Alex.
Hi, Will. Happy to be here again, as always. I feel like this must be my sixth or seventh appearance on the Michael and Us podcast. So I'm really happy to be invited back.
And it's even rarer to be an honorary co-host. We had Violet Luca be an honorary co-host last time Luke was out of commission. I'm not sure if we've had any others. So you're one of the few. This is like when Lou Costello couldn't perform one night. And so Jerry Lewis came out and performed with Bud Abbott, which is a thing that happened.
That's incredible.
This is a rare occasion. Well, we're gonna have a movie to talk about this episode. Boy, will we ever.
Well, it could be loosely described as a movie. Something,
right?
It's a series of scenes put together in sequential order that may or may not add up to something that resembles cinema.
Well, I mean, as a matter of fact, it used to have a letterboxed page, but it seems that both this and the other Doug Walker films, their letterboxed pages have since been removed. So somebody in Silicon Valley or whatever deemed that these were not movies, but I say that they
are. This is cancel culture in action. You know, we need to be petitioning Letterboxd. First they came for Substack and I said nothing. Then they came for Gab and I also said nothing because I wasn't a reactionary. And now they've come for Letterboxd and the cinematography of Doug Walker. That's actually quite surprising. I mean, do they remove a film if it gets like a certain like negative rating? Do they like remove a film, or is it just an arbitrary decision making process?
Yeah, like if a movie is so bad it ceases to be recognized as a movie. When we did the last episode on Channel Awesome, I went on Letterboxd to see, you know, what the grades of these movies were, and they are overwhelmingly half star, overwhelmingly people hating them. So I think maybe somebody from Channel Awesome itself. I'm getting conspiratorial now. Maybe somebody from Channel Awesome. Petitioned Letterboxd and said, you know, we got to shut this down. We're not actual movies. We should not be judged this way.
That would actually be very appropriate for the content of what we just watched. So not being judged as an actual movie. So I guess we'll talk more about that. But I guess the pressing topic that we were sort of thinking about, the revelation that Homer Simpson, long a hero to the boomer generation, has been revealed to in fact be a millennial. This was, frankly, quite disturbing to me. I felt like it was something created in a laboratory by the NSA or the CIA as a psyop, personally, to destroy the last remaining shreds of my consciousness. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I definitely feel disturbed by it. This is a recent episode of The Simpsons where, yeah, they retcon the origin story to make it so that Homer grew up in the 90s. Like, if he was the age that he is on the show, he would have theoretically grown up in the 90s now because the show has been on for 30 years. I mean, I guess this means Grandpa Simpson is no longer a World War II vet. Like, is he still part of the Fighting Hellfish or whatever that group was?
Hey, what's the haps, Pop Diggity? Oh, what's wrong with you? Can't you talk like a normal 55-year-old man? You'll never understand hip-hop, Dad. I understand plenty. You're wasting your life trying to be some kind of DJ. It's DJ, Dad, and you'll see. I'm gonna have my mom and check your watch. It's Homer time.
Well, I mean, to me, this sort of feels like a breach, not unlike when they revealed that Seymour Skinner's name was really Armin Tanzarian. You know, they did this kind of radical reset of a character. I mean, I think it sort of speaks to you the ways in which The Simpsons as a cultural artifact has kind of just persisted. But I mean, who watches The Simpsons? This is the question I always have. I mean, you can sort of recognize the zeitgeist it had when it was popular, but what about now? I mean, who is that audience?
No idea. I mean, I actually don't think many people watch it. I think it only gets like 2 million viewers an episode. Although that is still 2 million people. This isn't the first time they've retconned the origin story, by the way. I remember about 10 years ago, they did an episode where they changed it so that Homer, before he had Bart, he founded the grunge movement in Seattle in the 90s. God. So he would have been like in his 20s at that point in the 90s.
But then what about the B-Sharps, though? That doesn't make any sense. How could he found grunge and then also be the head of the barbershop revival?
Yeah, and I mean, this is the kind of thing that happens and is just designed to drive insane fans of the show, because one of the things that was so great about The Simpsons when it was at its peak was how meticulous and detailed the diegesis of it was. The fact that there was this lore that kept accumulating, and then when they just kind of like throw a sledgehammer to it and say it doesn't matter, you know, it is a bit frustrating, I guess. But one of the main reasons why it doesn't work, retconning the origin story, is okay, if Homer grew up in the 90s, if Homer actually is a millennial, he wouldn't have the lifestyle that we see him having on the show, would he? I mean, Homer on that show has an entry-level job and has had an entry-level job for many years working at the nuclear power plant. And from this entry-level salary, it's just a single-income family that has a two-story suburban home and three kids. Like, that was a premise that made sense in 1989, but it doesn't so much make sense now. Like, if Homer were a millennial, he may at most have one kid. And, you know, he would have been laid off from his power plant job because they had tried to unionize.
Yeah, or, you know, they replaced him with some sort of AI. You know, he'd be working like a gig economy job or something like that, having to learn how to code. Or it also has implications, I guess, as you were saying, for like the lore of the rest of the show that changes a lot of the relationships that were built up. And I guess, you know, there's a danger. You could sort of sound like that one nerd in that episode where he's like talking about Scratchy's magic xylophone, you know. But it's like, the thing is, though, it does feel really inconsistent and it doesn't really evoke the same thing. I mean, do you think it's based on this misplaced idea that, oh, there are a lot of people now in their 30s who are Simpsons fans. They watched The Simpsons in the 90s. So we're going to make Homer a millennial because that sort of reflects the people who are still talking about The Simpsons online. Do you think that was the logic behind it?
I think there's probably something to that, as well as just like the fact that it's illogical that Homer would be born in like 1950 or whatever, and he would have like an 8-year-old son who was born in 1985. But I mean, speaking as a millennial myself, I mean, one of the things that was so compelling about The Simpsons when it was at its golden age was that it didn't talk down to viewers. And in fact, it seemed very rooted in like a boomer or older Gen X worldview, mm-hmm. and milieu, yeah. and sensibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about how many jokes they made about Krusty the Clown basically being Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, I was thinking, I saw the episode Cape Fear. I rewatched that recently. Bart gets Sideshow Bob to sing the entirety of the HMS Pinafore, which is incredibly hilarious, but you can't imagine a joke like that being made now. And I think that charm of referencing a particular culture or sort of engaging with a particular cultural milieu, you also see that in a lot of the classic Looney Tunes.
Oh yeah.
And there wasn't this feeling of needing to pander. And I think that's what makes them so interesting and also so funny, and why the early seasons of The Simpsons and even those early Hollywood cartoons, they've proven, I think, maybe a little more durable than they seemed at the time. Because I think in animation, especially, is always at risk of feeling disposable. And it's always surprising to people who work in animation when shows or things are latched onto. I mean, Chuck Jones and the other great animators at Warner Brothers, I mean, they didn't imagine that people would still be watching them, you know, 70, 80 years from now.
Well, those cartoons, like early Simpsons, you may not understand every reference, but you believe that it's coming from a time and place. You believe that there's something authentic about it. And also, like, one of those cartoons, like, for example, Hollywood Steps Out or Book Review, one of those ones that's full of, like, a lot of topical references and caricatures of celebrities at the time. You know, as a kid, you may recognize, okay, that's the Three Stooges,
yeah.
or that's Charlie Chaplin or something.
Or Tarzan.
Yeah, or Tarzan. Or you may not know all the other ones, though, but like, you're kind of intrigued by it. And over the course of your life, if you revisit that cartoon, you'll fill in the blanks. You'll realize, oh, that was Humphrey Bogart. That was Betty Davis or Greta Garbo or someone. And that's exciting. A kid isn't necessarily going to turn it off just because they don't get it. They'll be intrigued.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. I think that there's this feeling that meeting people where they're at means always referencing the things that they're involved in or the things that they look at in their daily lives. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that you can sort of give somebody or talk about something that's outside of their own experience. I mean, I'm sort of thinking about this in terms of teaching, right? So I, you know, as a teacher at the University of Toronto, you know, I end up teaching a lot of people who are much younger than me. And I find that actually, you know, they really don't want you to be making references to like specific like Instagram memes or like TikTok trends. I mean, they don't want that. That's not what you're there for. I mean, also, in addition to being, you know, generally twice the age almost, you know, of most of my students, but also, I mean, you know, if they're in a tutorial with me, I mean, they want to learn the material. They're sort of looking to you to provide that. There was one thing that I saw recently where, have you heard of this game Among Us? Have you heard about this?
I've heard the name, but I don't know anything beyond that.
So somebody had made a joke recently about college administrators using Among Us. And it's this game where it's a social game, kind of like Werewolf, where somebody is, you know, the murderer or somebody's the person who, you know, and so, you know, they basically have to figure out who the imposter is. Well, somebody had made a joke recently about, you know, colleges essentially using Among Us as a way of like, as a teaching tool for like counseling and mental health, and really just as like a joke. And then it was revealed, I saw online that this had actually been happening, that people were actually constructing entire campaigns, mental health campaigns around this game. And the thing is, you know, working in the university milieu where there's a lot of stress, a lot of pressure, and I think maybe even more so than when I was doing my undergraduate degree, when you see how under-resourced a lot of places are, it sort of does feel a little cruel, right? Like, it sort of feels like a mask for a deeper structural issue.
By the way, while we're on this topic, before we get to the movie, Alex is an academic. I recently listened to Alex, and I encourage all of you to listen to Alex on our friend Jesse Hawkins' podcast, Junk Filter. You were recently on talking about video games, which is a subject that you've done a lot of academic research on, and more specifically talking about the gamification of movies or the movification of games. Subjects such as GoldenEye 64 and the movie Crank with Jason Statham, other relevant topics like that. So before we get into Suburban Nights, could you tell the listeners a bit what some of your own PhD research is?
It does focus on the games industry, but it sort of focuses on a weird part of the games industry where games and gambling are converging. So recently there have been a lot of controversies around things like loot boxes, you know, which are, for people who don't know, they're these chests that you can get, you can win them in games, and they will sometimes randomly give you items that are usually cosmetic, but you can also buy them, right? So you don't just get them through the gameplay, but you can also buy them. And there's a whole black market that's actually arisen around these items. So even though they don't really have an effect on gameplay, you know, there are a number of games, very popular online games, that actually have gray market or black market economies where people actually gamble and trade these things as speculative currencies. And what I'm looking at specifically are these apps that you download from the App Store called social casino apps. So they're basically like slot machine games that, you know, it's interesting because some people might look at something like Candy Crush or, you know, another popular casual game and say that has features of gambling. But these ones are explicitly gambling games, but they're not really regulated in the way that other gambling products are. Like if you make a slot machine, you know, it's subject to particular taxes and particular regulations around odds. Like even the odds are sort of set in a way that's legal. But because social casino apps, the things that you win aren't considered things of value. You can't take any money out of the app. So you can put money into it to buy coins and in-game items. But because it lacks the sort of real monetary prize, they don't really get regulated as gambling products. And I guess the way I sort of got interested in this was that it's been very strange to me, you know, noticing the ways in which games have sort of gone from being these sort of more stable experiences that sort of, you know, I mean, not to say that they aren't still like this, but we're, you know, starting from this premise of being, okay, it's a very specific type of experience based in, you know, a cartridge or CD, to, I think, thanks to network infrastructure and digital distribution, there have been found to be all these different ways of not only controlling the play experience, but monetizing it, you know, breaking it down into tiny little parts that you can then sell. And I think it's interesting that that's sort of a microcosm of, I think, what's happening everywhere. Now, increasingly, it feels like you're not engaging with something as a full experience or something. You're engaging with all these like micro experiences, and you have to pay a subscription for culture. You have to experience culture in these short little bursts. So I sort of study that as sort of an extension of kind of trying to understand the connections between things. And I feel like there's a few things that they're kind of off to the side, but I think are related to what I study. Like, for example, the Toronto Star announcing that they might be opening up a casino basically to help fund the newspaper, or explosion in speculative cryptocurrencies that have kind of this really indeterminate value, you know, people turning tweets and art and things like that into token that they can then try to sell for, you know, some sort of indiscernible value. And then also with this phenomenon of people betting things, you know, online. So I think it's just something that is deeply fascinating to me, and I think kind of captures a lot of the ways in which, you know, culture is changing and the economics of culture are changing, particularly in how really it emphasizes everything feels like it's procedurally generated. Nothing is allowed to necessarily, or okay, maybe this is too generalizing, but increasingly there's a feeling in which things are less stable. Things are much more contingent. I talked with Jesse about Cats basically getting a patch update. I mean, can you imagine that happening 20 years ago?
Just for a little context, that's the movie Cats that came out a year ago. The much derided film Cats, where for the first couple days that it was in theaters, there were some incomplete special effects. You could see Judi Dench's arm at one point where she was supposed to have fur on it. And then I guess the studio was able to do a quick patch job. And, you know, if you saw the movie after it was in theaters for a couple of days, you would have seen the completed special effect.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about this? As somebody, I mean, I think I maybe put a similar question earlier this week, but I actually want to know your perspective as somebody who follows film culture quite closely as well. You know, what do you think?
I don't know if this is a perfect answer to your question, but I've been thinking a lot this week about Zack Snyder's Justice League, the so-called Snyder Cut of Justice League, which just came out. That feels like an example of something that's not a standalone artwork. Like, several years of build-up towards it are an extension of the text and are even kind of part of the meaning of the text. Like, you had the Joss Whedon version of the film, the bastardized version of the film that came out in theaters. And then there was this whole online campaign that all of these Zack Snyder fans launched, leading to this movie that came out now. And I feel like the campaign and the previous version of the film are all extensions of the text. Or, like, I remember a couple years ago, Nick Pinkerton wrote a good review of The Canyons, the Paul Schrader film for Reverse Shot, which is certainly not my idea of a good movie, but Pinkerton was making a case for it that all of the pre-release build-up to it, Paul Schrader did a tweet-along viewing of the film, or, you know, he did so many Q&As, both virtual and in person, and, you know, the movie was financed on Kickstarter. All of that was an extension of the text somehow. I feel like movies are increasingly not standalone artworks in the social media age. The whole meaning of them has become a lot more interactive, it can become more interactive. Now, you can tell me if that fits at all into your thesis or if I'm off base.
I think that fits in. I mean, my work, when I write the thing, the document I have to produce at the end to get a PhD, it's going to be very hyper-focused on gambling, this idea of gamblification. Mm-hmm. But I think, thinking more broadly, I think you're totally right. It's like these networked flows are constantly interfering and interacting with things, right? And you sort of see it in the ways in which TV and movies are talked about. If you think about some of the films that came out in like the early to mid 2000s, I mean, the reception or the way they would have been talked about, even then, even with a network infrastructure in place, but before social media, it was very different. I think because there was still not a particular style or a particular thing that had solidified. And now I feel like there are particular styles that people gravitate to in terms of discourse, in terms of whether something should be dismissed, should be reassessed, not reassessed. You know, I see people kind of reaching for these shorthands a lot of the time. And I think maybe you see it, especially now, since a lot of movies they're not appearing in theaters, they're appearing on streaming services. You know, there's a collapse in terms of, you know, TV and movies more so than ever before. And this broad definition of, you know, content, which is kind of weird and disturbing to think about, you know, this idea of like everything is its own content universe. And that extends, I think you could say quite correctly, like, not just to the things that are made by the studio, but also to all the different discussions around it.
Because all this stuff is playing out on streaming services now, like, these streaming services are such sophisticated operations. They have very detailed data that they can mine to determine when people turn off a movie, what parts they play and replay, and, you know, they can hyper-tailor their content for their ideal audience. I don't know, it seems to me that the relationship between audience and content producer is it's much different now than it was 10 years ago. It's much closer. Not that the audience really has like any true democratic say in it, but like the content producer has much more access to who the audience mm-hmm. is and is tailoring the content for them much more closely.
But weirdly, you know, there's sometimes people trying to claim that we've entered into a more democratic age of media, but really if you look at in terms of, you know, who owns the media, the amount of convergence, the amount of kind of concentration, like for example in Canada, Rogers and Shaw just announced a merger, you know, that they're undertaking. And I mean mm-hmm. Shaw used to be part of the global, like it was part of that whole CanWest group, and then they got bought out, I think, by Bell. I think CanWest got bought out by Bell. And just you think about in Canada, what I think people might not realize is that our media is actually concentrated to a frightening degree.
Oh yeah, much more so than the United States.
Yeah, much more than the United States. It's a fact about, you know, the Canadian media sphere that I don't think is talked about enough. And maybe it, you know, there's a conversation here that's happening, but maybe not elsewhere. And it is kind of weird to think, I mean, for example, you know, the equity firm that funds one of them, the Post Media newspaper chain, I mean, if that collapses, Post Media collapses, I mean, that would remove a substantial number of newspapers in Canada. You know, it's sort of like there would be such a flattening. And I mean, there already is a kind of reduction. Like, I mean, I think about even 10 years ago, there was sort of a feeling of crisis then. And I feel like it's only gotten worse, right, in terms of just the shrinking of the amount of media outlets. And also with digital media, with the Huffington Post layoffs that happened recently.
Well, when I said a minute ago that there is a closer relationship between the content producer and the content receiver, like the end goal of that is monoculture. The goal is to get these algorithms tailored to the point where, like, you know the audience so well that the audience will have no need for any other content.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I've tried to hold on to is maybe the idea that the algorithms are not as predictive as people think they are. Like, I mean, in terms of mm-hmm. what they're able to target or what they're able to show. I mean, you know, with this digital advertising ecosystem, I think one of the things is it's like, you know, we hear about how data is the new oil, and a lot of that's related to the data ecosystem, and it is very important, and it does form an analytics that's applied. The degree, though, to which like these advertisements can affect behavior, like I always try to go away from like a hypodermic needle model. Like, I mean, I think that was one of the reasons I was so skeptical about Russiagate, where it's like, oh, you know, some people saw some Facebook advertisements or they talked in some Facebook groups, and then that led them to reactionary politics, because it doesn't take into account all the other political context that's there as well. Mm-hmm. And when you think about regular advertising, you know, especially the kind that we used to engage with more like cable news advertising, I mean, a lot of that is built around, okay, you have specific shows that build audiences, and then they're kind of trying to help you distinguish as a consumer. It's like they're teaching you how to consume in the sense of you're able to distinguish like one homogenized package good from another homogenized package good. Like this one brand of razor has more pep than the other one. And I think the effects of that, I mean, when there's no advertising, there's no awareness. So I think that does have an effect. But then, you know, what kind of awareness is being built? What kind of sense of brand loyalty and the degree to which rhetoric plays a role, right? You know, there have been all these claims that big data is going to lead to the end of theory. You know, we've been hearing about this for so long, and because it's going to be so predictive, but that itself is a rhetorical mode of discourse that's meant to shut down criticism and meant to move the conversation away from sort of thinking about what's actually going on. And as we see with a lot of these algorithms and systems, you know, they encode a lot of biases. They rely extensively on human labor, often quite underpaid human labor. So what can be frightening, though, is that this rhetoric takes over and there's the imposition of these programs and things, and they have an effect on people's lives, and that effect is bad, right? Like in terms of like things like policing, surveillance, people being kicked off of benefits and things like that. And because that discourse has been allowed to take over and it hasn't been interrogated, you know, and people sort of invest in this idea. And I think another way that maybe you can see social media affecting culture is maybe in the way in which people talk about it as well. And that has an effect. Like, it's interesting to me that like poptimism as a discourse arose like in the 2008-2009 period of crisis, because it was sort of seen as like, well, you know, we're all going through crisis. Maybe we can lean on these works that we've kind of looked down on to get us through this. But now what's happened to that is, you know, you must enjoy, like you must have enjoyment from these things. It's not enough to just be on the fence or indifferent or even negative. It's like there's sort of a feeling in which you have to enjoy and consume. And that's kind of concerning to me.
Yeah, like when people say about like the Marvel movies or something, they often say let people enjoy things when people criticize it. But it's not enough to just let people enjoy things. You have to respect their rightful place at the center of the culture. Speaking of things at the center of the culture, on a recent episode, we had Alex on to talk about 2011's Kickassia, which I know a lot of people listening to this podcast, even if they won't admit it, they saw Kickassia. It is a film by Channel Awesome and the nostalgia critic himself, Doug Walker. Well, we got a good response to that episode, and that's why with Luke fighting for his life on the operating table, we decide to pay tribute to him by talking about a movie that I knew that he would have a really hard time if we made him watch this movie.
Can you imagine Luke being forced to watch this? Because he barely, like, enjoyed Kickassia. I think, I remember, he said the only reference that he really got was Lindsay Ellis being forced to play Sarah Palin. But I think this one especially would have been pretty grating.
So what? The gauntlet. The magic gauntlet he was talking about.
Is there, like, some sort of medicine you should be on?
I found the meth that Jeffers made. If he knew where it was, if he left clues. All you have to do is just play a stupid game he created. Everybody has to get dressed up and act like a fantasy character in order to figure out what these riddles mean.
So it's like LARPing.
No, it's just a bunch of dorks dressing up and fighting for a fake reward.
While we're a bunch of dorks dressing up and fighting for a real reward.
Exactly. Now this is a manly costume.
Fuck, I will not avail you, flame of voodoo!
Save it for Broadway!
Inigo Montoya. Peter Pan,
Brian. You look like a steroid elephant turd.
Names will be remembered, quests will become legends, and legends will become legendary.
Well, I think once we're able to meet again in person, you, me, and him have got to sit down and watch To Boldly Flee.
Okay, so this is what I was about to say, is that, okay, Suburban Nights, when you suggested it as something that we're going to watch next, it terrified me, because I thought, okay, we've done the first two. To Boldly Flee is around the corner. So I don't know if I made this point.
You can turn it down if you want. We won't make you watch To Boldly Flee. I mean, To Boldly Flee may be unwatchable. Well, just based on the little bits of it I've seen.
I mean, I don't think that's a question. I think that's quite true. I mean, it's funny, this one Twitch channel that I sometimes watch, they actually did all the Channel Awesome movies. And one of the hosts compared watching To Boldly Flee to watching Come and See. He had the same emotional reaction at the end of that. Just like completely just dead inside at the end. Because, you know.
So something that I learned this week was that they made To Boldly Flee, which is. And by the way, folks, we'll give you context for what these movies are in a sec if you're just tuning in and you have no idea. But To Boldly Flee, they made it all indoors because the second one they filmed outside in like the cold Illinois winter.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And that was really hard on a lot of the cast, most of whom were like barely dressed in anything. Like they're wearing fucking, you know, Halloween costumes basically. And so the third one, they're like, okay, we're going to film this one inside. And it looks so claustrophobic. Like it's barely lit. It looks just like it's watching Inland Empire basically, but without any of the artistry.
That's the thing, though. I mean, wouldn't the solution to that being like, instead of having people come up during the cold Illinois winter, come up for like the summer or something? Like, I know that there's a certain timing, you know, for these movies, but couldn't they just shoot it at some other?
I fudged the facts just okay. A little bit. They filmed it in April,
right? Okay,
which is close enough to winter. Like it was.
It's like Toronto's.
Yeah,
April.
It was cold. Yeah, it was cold out there. Everybody had a really hard time, but folks. Suburban Nights, this is the second film, really a web series that was collected into a film by Doug Walker. And we're going to remember him so you don't have to, because he was the nostalgia critic. In the early 2010s and in the late 2000s, Doug Walker had a YouTube channel called The Nostalgia Critic, where he would review nostalgic movies and TV shows. You know, your Full Houses, your Jungle to Jungles, your Chairmans of the Board,
right, yeah.
You know, shitty shit from the 90s. And he would do comical shenanigans and make fun of them. We said all this on the Kickassia episode, but it's worth repeating because it's vital context. Many of the copyright owners of these movies started to go after him for basically using like a third of the movie as clips in his 40-minute videos. And, you know, he would try to claim fair use, but it was stretching fair use.
Oh, well, it is because, you know, the thing is, I actually watched a review of Suburban Nights done by one of the stars of Suburban Nights, Film Brain, where he was, you know, kind of doing a kind of parody kind of review, kind of reviewing it in the way that he would review other movies. And what was shocking to me was that most of that review is just made up of clips from Suburban Nights, which he stars in. So it's like that really reflected how weird it is to me, that particular reviewing style, which I would say now is completely gone out of fashion. People don't really do that to the same degree anymore.
Well, you say that, but I just checked. The Nostalgia Critic is still getting like 2 million views on his videos. It's there's an audience.
I mean, he's got 2 million subscribers. I don't know if he's pulling in 2 million, but he's pulling in probably like 100,000, which is still, I mean, for YouTube, that's pretty
some of them.
Big.
If he reviews like a big one like Aladdin from last year, he gets over 1 million.
Really? Okay. Wow.
Is,
okay.
And you know, a lot of that's just algorithms. A lot of that's just like people are looking for the Aladdin movie and they click on him by mistake. but he's out there. He's doing his thing. I think it's like children, basically, like 12-year-olds who watch his stuff.
Actually, can I jump off that point that you just made right now? Please. So this was something I was thinking about. So when Doug Walker was really popular, I was already 18 or 19. I was already in university. Watching Suburban Nights, I was beginning to think that, okay, really, this was built for an audience younger than me, even at that time, right? Is that wrong? Yeah. Because I was thinking about this, like I was thinking about other fan works that I used to engage with. For example, I used to spend a lot of time on Newgrounds.com. Did you ever spend some time?
No, I don't know it.
Yeah, so Newgrounds.com, it's a really well-known website that hosted, or it still hosts, it's still around. It became famous for hosting a lot of Flash animations, and it built an entire community and was really a repository of what we would now understand as meme culture, but like for the internet of the 90s and early 2000s. And there was this one film that was made, I think, around an anniversary for Newgrounds. So it's called Battle for the Portal. And the thing is, this is all animation, right? So it was done in 3D animation, and the portal was where you uploaded everything. So if you had music, if you had, well, for music, they had the audio portal. For art, they had the art portal. And then the portal itself was for a Flash animation and games and things like that. To understand this fan film, you would have had to have been part of like the Newgrounds community and been following this. It's 10 minutes long. It's 3 episodes. The entire thing is 10 minutes. Suburban Nights is 130 minutes long. And you have to have all of this prior knowledge, not just of the Nostalgia Critic's reviews, but of different characters, you know, the different film reviewers, the different skits that they did, and the other, maybe even other specials that they did. So the amount of like knowledge that you have to bring to, I guess, be a fan of this, I mean, it seems a little excessive.
Yeah, and this is lost knowledge, by the way, because a lot of these people's videos were hosted on a site called blip.tv, which they all invested in basically because it didn't have the same strict copyright policing that YouTube had. So Channel Awesome is where the Nostalgia Critic went after he got chased off YouTube, basically. He's back on YouTube now, but for a while, ChannelAwesome.com had this partnership with blip.tv. And blip.tv went out of business a few years after Suburban Nights came out. So all these people you see in this movie, they were all doing their content on blip.tv, and it's all lost now.
Unless they archived it themselves, I think, yeah.
But many of them didn't. I mean, maybe it exists somewhere, but nobody's archiving this knowledge, really, and putting it out into public view. So this is an incredible fossil from a lost civilization, just like Kick-Ass it was. But by the way, to your point about how this was for people younger than us, in the research that I've done into Channel Awesome, a lot of its appeal was that like these are relatable guys.
Right.
In this movie, we see 24 of these kind of like
bearded.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna do any ad hominem attacks, but yeah, definitely like kind of neck beard types. I'm sure many of them are wonderful, nice people. You know, no disrespect to them, but yeah, a lot of people who are just kind of like normal guys who kind of lucked out in the early 2000s doing their movie reviews. They're like, hey, remember Flubber? Well, here's a 20-minute video about Flubber. And what's the deal with this green slime that dances and shakes its butt? You know, it's like that kind
of
the
worst moment in Suburban Nights is when they put in that videotape. And I think Lindsay Ellis or one of the other reviewers there says, oh, well, the credits are already terrible. And then Doug Walker's like, don't review it. And it's like...
Very self-satisfied.
Very self-satisfied, yeah.
These guys, they just can't help
They just can't help the reviewing thing.
Hello, I'm the Nostalgia Critic. I remember it so you don't have to. Well, guys, this is it. The big one. The shitstopper. The constipation of American cinema. A bowel blockade from which nothing of any value can possibly be removed. What is said to be one of the worst films of all time. I am, of course, talking about the indescribable terror that is Joel Schumacher's Batman and Robin.
But yeah, like, these guys, they were very normal people, and in these reunion videos that they would do, they would make these movies one year after another, Kick-Assia, Suburban Nights, and To Boldly Flee. And the appeal of them to those who found them appealing was, okay, the production values are shit. Okay, like, there's nothing good about them. But what they are is just hanging out with our buds. And look at all these guys together. Like, they're a family. You know, a family of content producers. And wouldn't it be awesome if I was part of this family of content producers? Because there are a ton of, like, Channel Awesome takedown videos on YouTube that I've now sampled because I've fallen into this rabbit hole. You know, they'll say things like, God, you know, I used to wish that I was on Channel Awesome. That would have been so amazing. And, like, you can imagine how that would be especially attractive to, let's say you're a kid, let's say you're 15 or 16 years old and you're in suburbia and, you know, you may be a little nerdy. You know, you don't have a lot of agency. You don't have a lot of mobility and opportunities to connect with like-minded people aren't really out there for you. But what you do have is this Channel Awesome community.
Well, do you feel like that Michael and us is building the Channel Awesome podcasting? You know, is there an extended universe of podcasting you feel like you're a part of?
Well, I mean, we're like Channel Awesome only in the sense that, like, we abuse and horribly mistreat all of our guests. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but, like, this episode has taken 23 hours to record, and
oh my God.
We haven't fed Alex anything. We haven't given him any water.
You know, that was actually the most horrifying revelation, I think, in all of this, was that they would film for, like, TV production style days. Like, we're talking, like, 14-hour days. And, of course, but the thing is, in a TV production, you know, there's, like, food, and there's, like, moments to sit down, and
people can go to the bathroom in TV production, yeah.
Yeah, whereas, like, with this, like, they did not provide any of those things. I actually, one thing I've always wondered is, thinking about, you know, how stressful this must have been. And the fact that, you know, To Boldly Flee, I would argue, was sort of the beginning of the end for Channel Awesome in terms of really driving away certain reviewers from the site and really highlighting a lot of the problems in Channel Awesome. I kind of wonder, why did they make these? I know we're talking about kind of appealing to the fans and sort of hanging out with your buds, but I'm like, I mean, well, you've been involved in a like couple of film projects, you know, just with other people and not in a huge way. And I'm sure those were hopefully pretty stress-free experiences. I'm just wondering, why does someone go to all the trouble of flying people out? And you can sort of see how the people who are on the website, you know, they sort of felt the need to do these movies because they're part of the site. It's kind of a way of promoting themselves, their work. They're kind of being forced to do it as the employees. But if I'm the mastermind, if I'm the Walker Brothers, why am I doing this? Like, this is something I was thinking about the whole time. Is it about power, control? Like, this is the thing. Why make these movies? I don't know if that's a weird question.
I definitely think power and control has a lot to do with it. I mean, as I was sitting there today, you know, got up bright and early, had a hot cup of coffee in my hand, and I'm like, okay, it's time to check into the factory and do my factory work for the day and watch all 130 minutes of Suburban Nights. As I'm sitting there staring at this movie, which has not a single beautiful image in it, and I'm trying to, like, get something of value out of it, what overwhelmingly comes across is the presence of Doug Walker, who is the leader of this enterprise. He is on screen relentlessly. In my research, I found that there were a lot of people, a lot of these content creators, who were quite miffed by him, the fact that he would write roles for them that basically had nothing to do with the kind of content they were making, nothing to do with the personae that they created online. It was all about Doug.
It's how he sees them, right? So Film Brain is, like, obsequious and, like, high-pitched and annoying. And one of the, I think, more disturbing trends is I feel like he writes a lot of the female characters as nags. You know, they nag, they're angry, or they're overly girly. Like, there's a resentment towards, I think, some of the female reviewers on Channel Awesome. And then all the other guys, they're betas compared to Doug Walker. I mean, I use that only because that's how they're presented in the movie. What's funny, though, is how they're all written to also hate the Nostalgia Critic.
Well, that's self-effacing. That's self-deprecating. Right. Like, ha, ha, ha. Like, they hate him because he's the boss, right? And ultimately, that's flattering to himself.
Yeah.
I mean, in Doug Walker, we definitely see a guy who, like, I mean, ultimately, I think that he got all these people together. Also, just have a captive audience for his shenanigans. This is a frustrated comedian, kind of lucked out that he was in the right place at the right time and came upon the right formula. YouTube was exploding in the mid to late 2000s, and millennials were at a certain age, and he knew that if he did a video that's like, hey, remember Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue? That would poke at certain nostalgic pleasure centers, and like, he wouldn't even really have to do a whole lot. And I think that also gnawed at him after a while. I think he got a little frustrated because he wants to be a filmmaker, clearly. You wouldn't go to all these absurd lengths if you didn't want to be a filmmaker. Yeah. And he wanted to be a comedian in his own right. So after this, he canceled the Nostalgia Critic for all of 6 months so that he could start another series called Demo Reel, which I watched an episode of today.
What was Demo Reel? I've actually never watched this before.
What is Demo Reel? I'm glad you asked. You got movies, old and new, big budget and low budget, appealing to all sorts of different audiences. And as great as all these movies are, in all humbleness, we can do them better.
Imagine Be Kind Rewind meets a Christopher Guest comedy. So it's a mockumentary thing about a cut-rate movie studio that does cheap remakes of movies. So it'll be Doug and two other actors doing a cheap Be Kind Rewind type remake of like The Dark Knight.
So it's just him being parasitic on other people's content, like once again.
Yeah, but in this one, he doesn't use movie clips. Right. It's just him doing characters and him doing voices and stuff. And this movie, overwhelmingly, it's one scene after another, Suburban Nights, of all these poor, helpless content producers just standing there in a field while this man mugs and makes sounds and noises and at one point shows his balls and his tighty whities.
Yeah, I mean, I want to dive into some more things. Do you think we should give people like a sense of what the plot is? Because I feel like...
please. If you can do it, by all means.
Okay, I mean, because I've got some more things to say related to what Will said, but I feel like, you know, just so we don't get too abstract, you know, we should kind of say what the ostensible plot is. So the ostensible plot is that 30 or 40 years ago, a computer programmer / Dungeons and Dragons tabletop role player named Jaffers discovered a magical artifact called Malachite's Hand, which he has buried and created a map. And then to get Malachite's Hand, he created his own kind of role-playing game and universe. How he was able to sustain this for 30 years, it's never really explained in the movie. But basically, the whole thing is that in order to participate and find this magical item, this MacGuffin, you have to dress up as a character from like a quest-based fantasy world. So Doug Walker dresses up as Link from The Legend of Zelda. Bennett the Sage, he's Aslan.
The cinema snob is Indiana Jones.
And they spend like 12 or 15 minutes basically just introducing everybody's character.
Too many characters, too many plates spinning in the air.
This part elicited probably one of the few genuine laughs for me when, I guess his name is Bennett the Sage. He comes out as Aslan and they all start doing the Cowardly Lion voice at him. I actually thought that was pretty funny.
While we're on this, I actually did chuckle twice in the first 10 minutes and I could not believe it. I was like, fuck, I've laughed twice. Let's go, Doug. Like, maybe I'm going to be pleasantly surprised by the rest of this because I laughed in the opening scene where one of the guys, like, he's got an invitation that says, oh, free
car.
I got a free car if I show up to this place. And then he shows up and he sees all the other reviewers and he starts freaking out. I laughed at that. And I also laughed. I thought a nice bit of comic timing when Doug Walker is doing this like epic movie trailer voice, like, oh, we're going to embark on this epic journey. And then he turns around, and he sees everybody's left the room.
Yeah.
I just thought the timing of that bit
was good. It's interesting you bring up timing because I think a big problem with Suburban Nights is that every joke is either too short or too long. When it's too short, it's because the joke has started and nobody goes along with the premise of the joke. It's rejected. Everybody shouts, no, shut up. Oh, this is stupid. So the whatever joke is trying to be told doesn't have a chance to be told, or it goes on too long. We've gone way past the point where it could possibly be funny, and it's not only bent, but it's broken. It's just this one bit that's extended on and on and on. You know, I think with a little judicious editing, maybe it could have been a little bit funnier. Like when Film Brain gets recruited into the group of people with the swords. They're like the Nazgul.
Those are the villains, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah. And they have this kind of Monty Python-esque bit where they kind of are sick of Filmbrain. They want to get rid of him. And at first, it kind of starts off, you can sort of see what they're trying to set up. Okay, they're going to try to distract him, or they're going to sort of have something, some absurd reason for getting rid of him. But then it goes on for so long, any comic potential is basically drained out of it.
There are like a million gags that are some variation of somebody will be talking in a very serious voice, kind of like an Ian McKellen Lord of the Rings voice. And then somebody will say, why are you talking like that? And you'll say, I don't know. It's because you talk like that in movies like this. There are 500 jokes that are a version of that.
Yeah. There's no consistent characterization. Actually, one question I had while watching this was, what is Doug Walker actually like? Like, I think about somebody like Ed Wood. You know what Ed Wood likes. Yeah, people make fun of him, but he has passions. I sort of have the sense, I know what Ed Wood is passionate about. And the same thing with, you know, other filmmakers, you know, where you have a sense of, this is what they enjoy. This is what they're into. What is Doug Walker into? I feel like I'd never get a sense of that.
If I were to hazard a guess, I'd say he probably has like pretty standard nerd boy taste. This is a movie that has a lot of blockbuster fantasy and comic book movie imagery in it. So I think he probably basically likes that stuff. He's built a career out of being the guy who takes that stuff down and makes fun of that stuff. But I think that's still basically the stuff that he likes. I think also just judging by the sense of humor of the movie, he probably likes, I don't know, like Monty Python or, as I said, Christopher Guest. Your classic dorm room comedy standbys.
But then he uses it as material for roasting. He kind of absorbs these things because he wants to show that he's above it in some way, or that he can do it better, or that he can use it and he doesn't even have to try. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I have to be careful about being hypocritical on this because I have a podcast where that's like 50% just making fun of stupid garbage. But one of the reasons why Doug Walker, I think, appeals to teenagers particularly is when you're a teenager, you don't have a lot of achievements. You don't have a lot of accomplishment. I know this because I was once a teenager myself. You also don't have a firm sense of identity yet. You haven't done a whole lot. And one way to define yourself is to make fun of things, to laugh at things and be like, okay, well, I grew up with that sort of thing, but I've evolved past that now. I've evolved past jungle to jungle. and now I can make fun of it with this guy who's my friend.
Yeah, and now I can watch the more racist original version in French of Jungle to Jungle.
Little Indian Big City, beautiful film. Well, clearly the Walkers wanted to have it both ways, where it's like, okay, we're filmmakers, we're making a big, ambitious, we're making a real movie, but also they're like, this isn't a real movie, so if it looks shitty, if it doesn't make any sense at all, if it's horrible, well, that's because it's not a real movie. Like, we're just friends, we're hanging around. And one of the many grievances that came from the cast of this film is that they didn't have any food and water on the set. And, you know, apparently at one point, one of them said, why isn't there food? And Doug Walker was just kind of like, you gotta be kidding me. And then somebody else was like, no, seriously, you have to have food here. This is a film production. Yeah. And he was like, okay.
There's actually a making of featurette for Suburban Nights, which I didn't make myself watch. I thought I kind of had enough.
It's called Burden of Dreams.
Yes, exactly. How many people died to bring the Opera House upstream? Yeah, you said that there are no beautiful images. I was kind of done with the movie after about an hour. Like, I couldn't really watch it. I had to do it in two sittings.
Yeah.
So I did the first hour last night, and then I did the other hour while I was having lunch in my kitchen, you know, on the side. And
So didn't have your full attention is what you're saying. You're disrespecting Doug
Walker.
Well,
you know, I did the thing. I watched it on my phone, actually, the second hour. You know, I could hear David Lynch screaming at me because, you know, I wasn't experiencing the power of cinema the way it was meant to be seen. But, like, the thing is, like, you have to find some low-resolution device to watch. You know, you can't put this up on a big screen because it's really hard to get through. I mean, you know, I will say, like, I think there's a little more awareness of light sources. I wouldn't say that it's particularly lit in a very inspiring way because, obviously, they just used whatever natural light was available in April in Chicago. It's like there's no sense of staging, blocking, how to set a scene, make it interesting, add a little bit of business here and there. It's sort of just very straight from the camcorder. I mean, that's what it feels like.
And in case we haven't kind of conveyed the sensual experience of watching the film, imagine 130 minutes of a bunch of guys who look like you and me standing in a field dressed in Halloween costumes, and you've got it. That's the movie. And recorded on the worst store-bought camera that you can get.
Okay, let's get away from some of the negativity. I mean, some people do give, like, I think, spirited performances. I think Spoonie is one of them. Brad Jones, the cinema snob. I think he's generally okay in these things. Like, you know, he gives a kind of entertaining affect.
That guy, by the way, has made a ton of movies of his own. He's made, like, the cinema snob movie. Which maybe fodder for a future.
That's
Michael
the thing.
Has.
Like, I mean, I maybe to get away from To Boldly Flee, we could watch the other channel awesome movies that were created, like Atop the Fourth Wall. Though the problem with Atop the Fourth Wall is that it's set in a continuity after To Boldly Flee.
Oh, so we have to watch To Boldly Flee first to fully understand it. I think what I find overwhelmingly interesting about this movie and the other channel awesome movies is almost everyone that you see on screen, with maybe one or two exceptions, has since disowned these movies, has disowned Channel Awesome, has spoken about how much they hated it. And these movies remain as fascinating artifacts, not just of a vanished civilization. All these content producers who now no longer have a record on the internet. It's interesting for that, but also just as these like records of an abusive and difficult workplace. These are like the company picnic. We're all having a great time, we're all having fun, and we all have this great boss who we love. And years later, we find out that actually they all hate this guy. And when you watch the movies through those spectacles, the movies become very compelling. They become, you know, these stories of this fucking guy, this guy who has a captive audience, this guy who just cannot shut the fuck up. And he's made all of these people come to Illinois and sit there and watch him. And when you watch them like that, they are beautiful documents to the fact that your boss is not your friend.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's interesting that you say that, that watching them again with hindsight gives them a new context. And that can be actually quite disturbing. So, I mean, one of them is, after they've all left, Doug runs out and says to them, well, you have to do this or you're all fired, right? Yeah. Or actually, I don't know if you know about this, but one of the characters who's played by one of the producers, Ju Wario, plays Jareth. That's actually very disturbing in retrospect, because it was revealed during the Not So Awesome scandal that he had been fired from the website for like sexual predation of fans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. So you think about what he's put, you know, they make all these jokes about Jareth's, you know, David Bowie's package. And then they have the female producer swooning over him. And in retrospect, that is like aged really horribly. And then also, I mean, I think another complaint was how female producers were treated on Channel Awesome. And I think you sort of see that in the ways in which some of the producers, female producers, like, you know, Lindsay Ellis and Allison Pregler, are sort of written in the way that they're treated, you know, in terms of the film. And then the So Boldly Flee, I think, also continues that trend of kind of, you know, putting them in very kind of condescending roles, right?
Well, I know that To Boldly Flee has a rape joke in it. That was a major bone of contention. They made two of the people, I'm not sure who it is, but they made two of the people enact this rape joke basically against their will.
Yeah.
Run like children! Run!
Best be on our guard. Don't trust anyone.
You know, I've decided I'm terribly afraid of you.
You betrayed Shiva.
If you knew what was best for you, you would never return.
Well, Alex, I think we've just about put this movie to bed. I love hanging out in this universe.
Wait until, if we ever watch To Boldly Flee, I don't think you're going to be saying that any longer. I think it'll be probably the most depressing podcast that Michael and us has put out.
It's like, you know how they say that you forget the agony of childbirth? Well, I watched this movie earlier today, and I have never had a less enjoyable time in my life. And now here I am just being like, oh man, that was great. So fun talking about Channel Awesome and Doug Walker. So Alex, thanks again for coming on the show. You are a true soldier of Michael and Us Nation, and watch this drive.
They gave him a bat credit card. They had the balls to give one of the greatest superheroes of all time a bat credit card? No! No! Does not compute! Does not compute! Does not compute!
I apologize for that outrage. It was
childish and immature. I just get a little peeved when I see one of my childhood icons carrying a bad credit card, you bastards! I'll kill you! I'll kill all of you! All of you will die! You'll get that cash!
Channel Awesome does not want us to get the truth out. There was actual interference by deep government black book projects to prevent Michael and Us Nation from hearing the truth about Channel Awesome.
Yeah, Doug Walker was like...
That's what he does, like, every 10 minutes in a lot of these things. God. He starts screeching at the top of his
voice. Yeah, I was playing this movie in the living room, and, like, I did not have the volume high, but there's that gag that comes halfway through the movie where he just is, like, screaming for a minute. Like, he's like, ah,
yeah.
Ah, ah.
Yeah, yeah.
Did
your partner walk in on you, like, watching this at all?
Dancy was like, please turn this down.
I tried to convince Emily to watch it with me, but she refused, I think for good reason, because it's... pretty unwatchable.